My name is Kimberly Williams of the University of Florida, and I am interviewing Dr. Isaiah Lavender. Today is January the 30th. We are in Orlando at the University of Central Florida, and this is part of the Zora Neale Hurston Festival and Conference. So, if you could state your name.
Okay, I'm Isaiah Lavender the 3rd.
Yes. Awesome. And can you tell me a little bit about yourself and how you came into this work of Afrofuturism?
Oh my goodness. That is a simple, complex question all in one, right? So let me go with my standard answer. My earliest memory is Star Wars, and I remember seeing Han Solo shoot Greedo first, this fantastic green-skinned character in Star Wars, the very first Star Wars, not A New Hope as it's labeled number 4, but Star Wars, right? And I remember being thrilled by seeing Greedo's metallic green skin and thinking, oh, that's pretty interesting. This is me in 1977. I'm 3 years old. I saw it at the Angola drive-in in upstate New York, right? It's an important memory to me because, you know, it's my earliest one, and I can remember the trash compactor scene and falling asleep and waking up in my dad's arms as he carried me into our house in a light misting rain. And so that green skin stuck with me. I can relate it to movies even more when I think about Blade Runner and the voiceover where the captain to Deckard's character said, well, this is the kind of cop that referred to skin jobs or the replicants in the film as niggers. And I'm like, oh my gosh. And well, what's that? But then I had an awareness and a racial awakening sometime in between second and third grade when I used to like running against the bus. And in the morning, I mouthed off to some fourth graders because I had a fast tongue and what I thought were faster feet. And so I forgot that moment. And then I got off at the bus, 3 feet of snow in February. And I tried to race the bus in my Blue Moon boots, and I lost the race. And the fourth graders had gotten off the bus, and they circled me, called me a nigger, and kicked the crap out of me in my front yard. And I was in one of those fetal balls trying to protect myself. Bus driver got off the bus, saved my life when she came back around, because, you know, kids can go too far. And yes. So I remember bloody leaving a moon boot behind and getting into the front door and asking my mom later, Mom, what's a nigger? And so it was a big brouhaha at the school, as you can imagine, in a parent-teacher association. And being forced to ride at the front of the bus for the rest of the school year because they were trying to protect me. And my dad giving me the Martian Chronicles and my mom giving me the Martian Chronicles, one of them, and saying, read this story, way in the middle of the air, right? So that was a different moment. I'm just thinking of science fiction in general at this point. And then I also suffered from institutionalized racism and didn't know it. In second grade, I was put in special ed, and my teacher, Mrs. Ennis, who I thank every moment, said, you don't belong here. And through a novel called The Mouse and the Motorcycle by Beverly Cleary, had me into gifted and talented within 6 weeks. And so that was another formative moment where it seems like race and science fiction or fantastic literature has always inextricably been entwined in my life. And both of my parents were avid readers. And so I read all kinds of things that I should not have read, like Harlequin romances, Johanna Lindsay and Beatrice Small were the big writers, my sister's Sweet Valley High books and Babysitter's Club, Zane Grey and Louis L'Amour from Western traditions, and science fiction and whatever I could get my hands on, like choose your own adventure novels and twist of plots and endless quests. And so those were the kinds of things that I was reading and playing with my Star Wars and very different, you know, action figures at that time, because they came in multiple sizes and colors. And those were interesting times in my childhood. Afrofuturism for me really doesn't come about until Milestone Media in 1992-93, when I was a freshman at the University of Pittsburgh and in the Homewood section, and going to the comic book shop and say, oh my gosh, this is so cool, right? And so I know Reynaldo was talking about, he's a Marvel man. I read Marvel too, but I was mostly Milestone Media because of the four comic books that started Milestone Media: Hardware, Static, Blood Syndicate, and Icon. And I collected all of them. And I have one of those sad stories about when I transferred to Southern University for the rest of my undergraduate career for 3 years. I stayed with my aunt that was there, and I left my comics there that I was accruing on a weekly basis. And when she moved back to Atlanta, she tossed all my stuff out, right? One of those sad stories, because I wish I had that collection. But, Virgil Hawkins from Static was really an important character for me. And so he became Static Shock. They even gave him a role on the cartoon series, right? And so that was kind of neat, because it helped me see Black culture in a different way, just like the Blood Syndicate group and that bad guy team up in that novel, right? Or villain team up, I should say, was another way of seeing the world in this city, the Dakotaverse. And I haven't realized how strongly that Milestone really influenced my way of thinking. But then I was also into reading Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man and Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass and Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, and thinking about what that past means for the future. In 18, 19, 20, I didn't know Afrofuturism existed. So in my first book, Race in American Science Fiction, I tried to create other hoods as my idea to combat Afrofuturism, because I was, for lack of a better description, dumb. I'm not going to let some white guy tag this entire thing for people in the world. It should be named by a Black person, and this is my attempt. And that was just idiotic thinking of a young 20-something working on a dissertation and saying, well, no, this is really something. And as long as it starts, and, you know, I'm a member of the human species, and take it out from there, then race is a silly concept in some ways, but yeah, it affects us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you so much for that very thorough and vulnerable sort of like trajectory, you know, of how you get.
I try and be as honest as I can in any situation.
Yeah. And so with that, and I know you kind of touched on that already, but anything else have you missed in terms of thinking about how would you define Afrofuturism?
Defining Afrofuturism is such a difficult thing. It's like trying to define science fiction. And so I would go with the idea that you know it when you see it. And that's why we have lots of people responding to Black Panther the way that they have, right? And when my 8-year-old says, I want to be a rhino rider, I'm like, wow, this is a really powerful thing that I've been studying that has gone filtered all the way down to my 8-year-old's mind in 2018. And he's almost 10 now, right? But that was an amazing statement to me. So when I think of Afrofuturism, the definition that I like is science fictional Blackness, in line with what Greg Tate says in the founding interview with Mark Derry in Black to the Future, where Black people live a science fictional existence. And then you expand on that with the idea that, well, Blacks were stolen by foreign people, alien people, taken to an alien environment in alien ships, forced to speak alien languages, and live an alien existence, if that's not science fiction, I don't know what is, right? And so that's another definition. As I was trying to think my way through Afrofuturism, I wrote my book, Afrofuturism Rising, and came up with ideas, at least new ideas and concepts to me, such as the networked black consciousness, which was not my own, right? That I just developed it further than Kodwo Ashun, at least in my opinion. And then the idea of the transhistoric feedback loop, where this history is informing the present, informing the future, and it goes in cycles in tandem with something like the hyper-real violence loop, which we can trace ad infinitum all the way back to the first Africans rise up, at least as we say, the 1619 project, the first Africans arriving in the New World. Of course, they were here before that, but you can see the violence inflicted on black bodies from then all the way up and through January 30th, 2020, because it's happening to someone that looks like us somewhere right now as we speak, right? And so in addition to that, you get black people communicating with each other across time. Maybe it's intertextual across space just through holding an object like Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass and seeing how this violence impacts us and how he thinks his way through it into the future and how Harriet Jacobs thinks her way through it into the future and how we can apply that now. And that provides us with a sense of hope. So I was calling that the hope impulse. Some people maybe call it Afrotopia, Utopian, and then people, well, how is Afrofuturism against Afro-pessimism? And I say, oh, no. Afro-pessimism falls underneath Afrofuturism because Afrofuturism isn't just about utopia. It's about the way there are different black worlds projected by black people and their writings. And then I had my mind blown in a piece that Delaney did for me in Beyond Afrofuturism, where he's just, white people can white Afrofuturism too, because it's images of black characters and black worlds, and white writers can do that too. And if we all belong to the same species as we do, then but that's really crazy beyond what we think in terms of Afrofuturism, which made it perfect for the double issue of Extrapolation. So I don't go that far in my own thinking, but it was said by one of the progenitors of Afrofuturism. So how can Samuel R. Delaney be wrong? Magnificent human being.
That is very true. Yes, that's very true. Yes. And again, I really love how organically you are offering transitions and bridging into every single question. So from your perspective, what does Afrofuturism offer society at this moment in terms of maybe its critique, liberation, or opportunity?
I think it is critique. It offers critiques of the past in terms of how people have lived together, have been treated. I think it provides a way into the future of race relations. What do I mean by the future of race relations? I mean, how we get along. Like, I was just in conversation that Reynaldo mentioned that book by that Muslim American, and he said he name dropped, he forgot the name, right? The name slipped his mind, and I'm like, oh, that's Omar Akkad, American War, which has a black protagonist in it, which is a pretty fascinating book when you move forward and you're looking at it, and it's in the 2070s. No, that's okay. And you are projecting into the future with that novel, where you have this civil war and this native of what was once Louisiana, a young woman with a long gun takes out the takes out the American president of the Union, and that's where it is. I still have 50 pages left to go in the novel. That's where I've ended. So I don't quite know where it ends yet. But that's one possible future, one act of Afrofuturism written by an Asian American or a Middle Eastern American projecting into the future. And I think that's what Delaney's talking about, because this viewpoint character is a black girl that takes up arms to fight for the South or the New South in the books. And you're like, wow, this is a fascinating text and take on it. And so I've lost the thread of your question, but just looking at, I've got it back. So it offers glimpses of possible futures and helps us see around issues of race, see around issues of gender, see around intersectionalities, to use Patricia Hill Collins's thinking, right? And so that's an important tool and avenue for human beings surviving as a species. I mean, how else? I mean, I'm thinking climate change and things like that now. So if we can't think our way through our own disagreements, how are we going to combat what we've done to this planet? Oh, the planet will fight back and kill us. And then, you know, what species will rise next? That's crazy.
Yes. That is true. We have seen that through, cinema and life.
Right.
That is very true.
Right.
That is true. So in your mind, what's the link between, you know, we're at this festival commemorating Zora Neale Hurston. What's the link between Hurston and Afrofuturism?
Well, I'm going to talk about that a little bit in my talk tomorrow. But for me, Hurston is an active agent of Afrofuturism, and that she has scientific training with Franz Boas at Columbia University. She has an ear for native dialects and an interest in capturing stories from her people that represent the Black diaspora in the United States and the Caribbean. And so she uses tape recorders and she uses cameras and takes pictures, these high-end technologies in the early 20th century to help tell these stories. And then she listens to them and she projects them in all of her novels, right? So Jonas Gordvine, and the hoodoo that is put on the main character is a fascinating Afrofuturist application when you go beyond the science and technology that is, my air quotes, that goes, you know, that takes Afrofuturism in a direction that we don't think of in terms of hardcore sciences. When you get into native scientific practices and religious beliefs, that opens up all of her work. And so you can see that on display in their eyes. We're watching God, Seraphon the Suwannee, Moses, Man of the Mountain, and her short stories. And so all of it is relevant to what she does. Like, I was fascinated by hearing about the esoteric traditions. It's an avenue of thought I never even considered that Rinaldo was telling us about in his keynote. And so I think she has everything to do with Afrofuturism. I think after Zora Neale Hurston and before Octavia Butler, there's a direct link and connection there. Where is the missing link? That's something that I'm interested in now, finding that black female author between those two writers, because there has to be.
Absolutely.
And so that's something that I'm going to go in search of. Maybe I shouldn't put that on tape, but I am.
Okay. Awesome. And do you think the Zora Neale Hurston Festival engagement with Afrofuturism continues Hurston's legacy?
Absolutely. And I say absolutely because different people are offering different perspectives and different ways of thinking about Zora Neale Hurston's work. You know, it's been read in terms of folklore. It's been read in terms of humor. It's been read in terms of race and gender. Why not? What it can mean for future generations? What kinds of future stories is she telling? All right. And I think if we just use their eyes, we're watching God. It's telling us how people can get together, how Black people themselves have been humanized by her story in ways that mainstream America might not have accepted. And, you know, I know Richard Wright didn't accept it when he criticizes Hurston's novel, but she had a much better ear for dialect than he does in Native Son. And so the two become enemies of a sort. And so, you know, interesting writers, interesting period. But, you know, Hurston's legacy is ongoing because she's condemned. I mean, I just listened to that Afrofuturism in Russia connected to Zora Neale Hurston. I was like, wow, this is fascinating. So her impact is still going. It's like a nuclear explosion, and we don't know when the radiation of her magnificence is going to end. I hope it doesn't. And so Zora Neale Hurston Society is doing fabulous work and thinking about the context of Hurston's novels and short stories and folklore and journalism and extending that into the future. Keeping her work alive is impacting future generations even now. And so I sound like I'm talking in circles, but this is that time loop that is a necessary thing as it's ongoing into the future. And so I can't wait for my own sons to encounter her work, so to speak. Yeah.
And that actually gets into, and of course you sort of touched on that just now, but really thinking about what can contemporary Afrofuturists learn from Hurston and also early Black writers and thinkers and scholars?
Can learn to listen. I mean, I don't mean, yes, you're reading the words on the page, but you're also, you know, creating this little motion picture in your head, this synesthesia, this synesthetic experience that she is producing, like the people on Joe Porch's, on Joe Starks's porch, right? Sharing thought pictures. It sounds like telepathy to me. And so I talk about that in my book, and I'll talk about that tomorrow in our talk. Or you could switch to like Sweat and Delia Jones and Joe Clark's storefront porch and the conversation that's going on there. You know, it may be in the past, but relationships between the sexes have been around forever, and they'll be around as long as the human species inhabits the earth. And so we can learn about how men and women think about each other and how we can cross the biological divide in a sense. And so I think her work is wonderful in doing this. And I also believe that there are undiscovered writers such as you heard the Princess Steele and W.E.B. Du Bois's early work that was recovered by Adrienne Marie Brown and Britt Russert. And these earlier things are being discovered all the time. And so what do you do with that? How do you examine that? What framework do you bring to it? And so it's like Jonna Kumfra's data thief in The Last Angel of History. We're coming back, finding this piece, bringing it into the future and talking about it and synthesizing it and thinking about the information and the snapshot of history that's provided and how you use that into taking that into the future, where you get a hip hop group like Clipping and their wonderful slave ship computer love story. Oh, I'm forgetting the name of the song, but it's fantastic. And you're like, oh my gosh. And you know, these artists are reaching into the past, mining it, taking it in the future, flipping it, remixing it, rethinking it, and saying, wow, this is how we think about the future of race. As long as it continues as a concept, Afrofuturism will be useful. Now, what can you do with it? I think it's representative of the colored wave of science fiction right now. So, which is Afrofuturism first, and indigenous futurism is taking off. Techno-Orientalism or Asian futurisms that have developed from that fear of the yellow peril back in the late 19th century is taking off. Indigenous futurisms, as I've already said, all of the Latinx futurisms, all of this can be linked back to Afrofuturism in a sense, and you can take that back as far as you want, and probably should. And so, in thinking about this, I think about Nnedi Okorafor and her resistance to being labeled an Afrofuturist. She is an African futurist, one word in her thinking, and yet there's resistance from the actual African continent. Hey, oh no, Nnedi, you're a first generation Niger American, right? You don't get to tell us what our writing is. And so trying to come up with a label of what science fiction fantasy from the African continent should be called. It's, you know, these debates can go on forever, and they should. It's a good, proper academic scrum, I guess, for lack of a better description. So I love it. I'm invested in seeing where it goes as long as I'm walking this earth.
And what I really like about your responses and your answers, it really just kind of defines and curates so much around like multi-sensory, multi-ethnic, multi-theory. And it sort of really makes me think about your text and Rising too as well. Did you want to talk a little bit about that sort of like creation making too?
Man, well, books are a hard thing. They're not hard, but they take a long time as you're sitting there thinking about stuff and distilling your thought and going out and presenting at various conferences and getting feedback and criticism and incorporating all of that into the production of a book. And so I purposefully did not want to write about Delaney's work and Butler's work and Stephen Barnes's work and Nalo Hopkinson's work at the time that I was writing, because those books have been written, those scholars, those authors have been written about in terms of science fiction and Afrofuturism as well. And I love talking about them. I love reading them. But I've come about to thinking of Afrofuturism as Black science fictional experience because of Greg Tate. And I decided that, you know, I've taught Their Eyes Were Watching God any number of times, and it always comes across as a science fictional work to me, but that doesn't quite fit it. So Afrofuturism, but I developed my own thinking on Afrofuturism to kind of fit how I saw Their Eyes Were Watching God and Native Son and Captain Blackman and Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass and any number of African-American texts that are not science fiction by any stretch of the imagination, but are Afrofuturism. And so that to me was the more important book to write than, I know people are going to write on Delaney as an Afrofuturist and Butler as an Afrofuturist and Stephen Barnes as an Afrofuturist, and I'm going to write on them that way too, but not at a book length. And I thought it was important to help answer the challenge of the idea that African American literature was dead. What was African American literature was the name of the book, and I'm forgetting the guy that had it that said it, which is terrible. Name blanking happens, right?
Yeah.
But that was also a conscious response to that. No, I don't think so. And so I was telling people, I also thought about writing a chapter on Song of Solomon with Toni Morrison, but that would have taken a long time because there's so much scholarship to sift through and a lot of thinking to sift through. But the myth of the flying African is something that needs to be discussed someone in terms of Afrofuturism. And I thought, well, someone else can write that story. If my book influences anybody, I would like to see that. I thought about writing on Flight to Canada as well, and Raving Quickskill's story and Uncle Robin in terms of being an Afrofuturism story, and it is. But then there was an Afrofuturism conference at Yale, and I had got wind of someone writing on flight to Canada, and I think I just saw it in African American Review or some such journal, that actual essay, and like, they said it pretty well. I'm glad I decided not to write on that story, even though I'd gone through my process and typed up every quote from that novel and typed up every quote from my research on that novel from journals and book chapters and books on Ishmael Reed, and like, sometimes you have to let things go. And so at one point I've felt, in the very recent past, I've said everything I want to say about Afrofuturism, but it seemingly will not let me go, right? And so I've moved on to my next book project, and that's critical race theory and science fiction. And so that's what my heart is in now, but I'm always paying attention to Afrofuturism. And I guess critical race theory and science fiction could fall underneath that umbrella that I think Afrofuturism has created for the study of race and ethnicity in science fiction, which is my bread and butter, so to speak.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And last question.
Okay.
If you could, if someone was coming in, they're like, Dr. Lavender, I really, really want to get into Afrofuturism. Could you give me almost like a seminal like mixtape of sort of entryway to kind of like get into, like 3 to 5 all across mediums? It could be artists, film, song, text.
Okay. A mixtape of Afrofuturism. One, I would see the film The Last Angel of History by Jana Kumfra. That's certainly an important work. Two, I would read Kodwo Ashun's work. Because he is an important Afrofuturist scholar, early Afrofuturism scholar. Then I would choose any book by Samuel R. Delaney, probably Dahlgren or Stars in My Pocket Like Grains of Sand, because he's excellent. Then I would also choose Octavia Butler in terms of her. I mean, you choose her just because she is magnificent, and I would go with Parable of the Sower because it's my favorite Butler novel. I think I would bring in the Caribbean-inflected version of Afrofuturism with Nalo Hopkinson's first novel, Brown Girl in the Ring. And musically, I would go with my favorite hip-hop group, Outkast. And I know there are lots of different groups, but that's who I'm partial to. Great. And so there's so much artwork. I honestly don't know enough about the world of art. But again, if I come back to the beginning of this talk, Afrofuturism when you see it. Mm-hmm. And so you have to have Black Panther, the Coogler film. You cannot avoid it. And I think I've given you like 8. And so there's so much. Where do you stop?
It starts up. Thank you so much again for your time and for your thorough, just really, really enriching responses and answers.
Thank you.
Really appreciate that.
Oh, it was a lot of fun.
Yes,
harmless, painless.